folks. You are listening to the Yishai Fleisher Show here on thelandofisrael.com, broadcasting from Jerusalem to the world, and you're a part of it wherever you are. Shalom and welcome. This is our favorite segment every week here. You know it. It's called Spiritual Cafe. And indeed, Spiritual Cafe is, I'm in need of a little bit of caffeine today, and I'm with Rabbi Mike Foy. Rabbi Mike, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
I had my cup of coffee, but I'm still feeling a little sluggish. Could it be because, I don't know, because life is just so awesome that it's just like overwhelmed us, because we are entering the month of Adar. And not only that, we got a double month of Adar, so we're entering a 60-day period where the hunted becomes the hunter, where the Jewish people are a kind of Pac-Man that eats the super pill and is now turns around and gets his enemies. For these 60 days, we're on top for sure in the eternal battle between Amalek and Israel, between negative energy and positive energy. I don't want to say it's an eternal battle because there is an end reckoning, but certainly, even halachically speaking, this period is one which is advantageous. Advantageous. It's asymmetrical here, asymmetrical advantage for the Jewish people, and that is marked by the incredible holiday of Purim, which is not going to be this month, but rather going to be in Adar Beit. So we are now basically a month and a half away. Still, though, the reason we have an extra month is because we have a lunar calendar that is buttressed by the solar calendar, and therefore we count the months by the moon, but we add months from time to time in order to keep Pesach in the spring months, and we've just added a month. Now, the month that we add is not the sad month, the disadvantageous month of Av, rather the month of Adar, the joyous month. Very smart thinking on the part of our leaders and great thinkers, in that we should add an extra joyous month. So happy Adar to you. Mishenichnas Adar, Marbin Besimcha.
Happy Adar to you too.
Okay. So what's Adar really about, though? Adar, the holiday of Purim, is certainly on the simple level a celebration. We beat our enemies. But there's so much more about Purim. And one of those things that's maybe not enough talked about is that Purim is also the second acceptance of the Torah, where Shavuot, the original giving of the Torah, which we're learning about in these week's Torah portions at Sinai, was the giving of the Torah, the full receiving of the Torah, happened in Purim. And it happened by full choice, not through a kind of childish slave mentality, receiving of something that's way bigger than our consciousness. No, in Purim, we receive after having gone down low, we come back to the Torah and we yearn for it, we ask for it. And it's not a coincidence that after that period of wanting to return to the Torah, we also, the period of returning to the land of Israel.
I mean, this is the essence of the Purim holiday, and I think the essence of the joy which we're called to in this month. Because the difference between the revelation that happened at Sinai and the acceptance of the Torah that went with it and the revelation that happens through Purim and the acceptance of the Torah there is the difference between the hidden and the revealed. You know, if you ask most people what's the essence of receiving the Torah, they'll talk about Sinai and how the miracles and the voices, etc. And it's often missed, although not by our sages, that in many ways that was to the disadvantage of our ability to accept the Torah. Because really, if you saw the mountain in flame, and you heard the voice of God saying the commandments, would there have been a choice there? No, in many ways, it removes choice. And the sages actually said that this is as if God held the mountain over us and said, take it or you'll die here. And then they immediately asked the question, well, doesn't that kind of undermine the ability to be punished for anything you might do wrong? And then the answer, as you noted, oh, don't worry, because later we came back and we accepted it of free will. And the key is that free will explains why God is not in the Book of Esther, why God is not obviously apparent, right? Because it was the very hiddenness that gave us the freedom to accept the Torah as something which we desire to do as opposed to something which must be done. And what could be greater joy than actually having a sense of mission, which is what we desire to do, which is an internally sort of upwelling desire to serve God, as opposed to an externally exposed, you know, awesome though it might be, at Sinai, which will always leave you thinking, is this really what I want? Or is it just simply what I was told needs to be done?
And that also is true of our time, in that there is a movement to the return of interest in Judaism. There's a great renaissance in Judaism. I don't think people always appreciate the incredible renaissance that we're living in. We're living in a renaissance of Jewish knowledge, Jewish books, Jewish education, a yearning, a thirst for Judaism and its vast storehouses of knowledge. That is related also to the yearning for the land of Israel, which is something that really came from the Jews. Yes, there was a lot of anti-Semitism, pogroms, and Holocausts, but there was also this returning to the love of the land, a return to the beautiful land of Israel, that concept, to wanting to work the land. With that, the return to self-defense, the ability to have to bear arms as a Jew, and the return to Hebrew. These are all different shades and flavors. I disagree with those people who say, well, it's all about Torah. Torah is one of the components of this big personality called Israel.
Well, there are three primary vessels for the relationship between Israel and God. And we've spoken about it before. I think it came up last week, right? The Torah, which more or less underlies everything, but there's also the land, and there's the temple, right? And if you think about it, in many ways, the people who returned to the land in the 19th and early 20th century did it by letting go of the Torah, right? And they came back to the land. And we're seeing a movement, I believe, back toward the Torah, although in ways that are often very confusing, because of the sort of principle of autonomy in our society, that basically what I believe is right is by definition what's right. So there's a lot of picking and choosing, and there are a lot of very new and I don't want to make judgments, just very new approaches to what Torah means. But nevertheless, I believe that that's drawing after it this big question of the temple, meaning we're here in the land. The Torah is reviving, and this question, which our enemies seem to have picked up much more quickly than we ourselves, is that there is a geographic location around which things are slowly beginning to revolve.
Yes. Well, we're going to get to the temple right now by talking about this week's Torah portion. By the way, Spiritual Cafe is sponsored by our good friend Jack, who is dedicating the show in honor of his wife Lillian, his sister Sarah, their amazing families, and his dedication is your a gift to you, because we get to share with you here Spiritual Cafe. If you want to be part of that, please go to YishaiFleischer.com and hit the support button. Be part of the great story. There's many other folks who are part of that, and I appreciate it so much. We appreciate it, and it spreads Torah to the world. That's our tafkid here at Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov, the Yishai Fleischer Show, and thelandofisrael.com. My email, by the way, is related to that, Yishai@thelandofisrael.com. This week's Torah portion is Teruma, and it is found in the book of Exodus. Starts at about chapter 25. Not about, but right on, chapter 25. And it's one of these blueprint Torah portions, but as opposed to last week's blueprint Torah portion, which was legal and social and political, this one is ritualistic and technical. When I say blueprint, in this case, I mean blueprint in the way you imagine blueprint. How do you build not a temple, but a tabernacle? The tabernacle, or I like to call it the tabernacle, is this roving altar, roving a place of worship that comes with the Jewish people wherever they are, and it's literally modular. It gets taken apart and put back together again in the most technical of fashions. It's carried and it's described how it's going to be carried, the kind of coverings, the pockets that are made for these vessels, and the whole technical apparatus about how to serve God. And It's like, I didn't know that you have to serve God with all this technical equipment. I thought that God was here, there, and everywhere, and I just kind of look up to him, and I just serve him however best my heart tells me. God says, no, here is the blueprint of how I want you to do it. It's got a certain look, and it's like, wow, God has a preference about if it's a rounded edge or a squared off edge. He has a preference.
Or at the very least, God senses that we have a preference that influences us. Because I think we see both in the comments around the dedication of the Mishkan, but particularly one of the most important chapters in the entire Tanakh, in the entire Bible, right before King Solomon, Shlomo Melech, dedicates the permanent temple in Jerusalem, right? That's in the second book of Kings, sorry, first book of Kings, eighth chapter. He gives an introductory speech there, which is one of the most important theological chapters in the entire Tanakh. And there it's really clear. Nobody's under the illusion that this is for God. right? That it's very clear that this is for humanity. And I think that the precision that we see in this parsha, the rounded edges, the gold, not the silver, the purple, not the red, etc., bespeak the depths of how much the physical influences our relationship to the emotional, the psychological, and the spiritual, right? Which is not, I don't mean to say that as a diminishing of the process, because don't forget, the Bible is not theology. It is not thoughts of man on God. These are the thoughts of God on man. And therefore, so much of what we can learn from the Mishkan is about ourselves. It's a tremendous insight, which is really all summed up in that famous line, Vasuli Mikdash, Vashachanti Bitocham, right? Make me a holy dwelling, and I will dwell amongst you, not in it, but amongst you, because if it is holy in the sense of what is expressive of holiness to us, then we will be able to find God wherever we are. This becomes the anchor. The act of making it awakens the holy within us, and then it becomes the anchor so that we can be orient ourselves to the holy wherever we are.
And that is the key phrase in understanding the temple and the tabernacle, is this phrase which is found, chapter 25, verse 8, Vasuli Mikdash, they'll make me a temple or a holy abode, Vashachanti Betucham, I will dwell within them. Within them, does that mean within the society, the Jewish society, or does it mean within them, within each, every individual? But I will dwell. I will come down. Shechinah comes from the word Shechinah, which is God's presence. I will make my presence come down into this world and be amongst you. That's basically. I have a parable about this. Okay, I want to keep it just right. The parable is that when you're married and you want to be close with your spouse. You want to make sure you don't smell bad, right? And because it offends the other person. So too, God says to us, if you want to keep me close, there's certain things, certain behaviors that offend me, and certain behaviors that draw me in. Put up a mezuzah in your home, and kiss it, and recognize it, and recognize that I'm coming to be in your dwelling. That's a way to bring me down. Behave improperly. Don't eat the right foods. Don't have the right relations. Don't have the right thoughts. Don't use language in a proper fashion. That turns me off. That pushes me out. I don't want to be close to you. And God says, you know, this system of the temple is and the tabernacle is a way by which to draw me down into your spheres.
So I'm going
to
offer some exegesis on your parable, which is I can imagine a situation in which my wife loves me so much that actually doesn't matter how I smell or how I dress. In the same way that we say that God's love is not conditional. However, what's in question really if I don't take care of myself, if I don't dress in a way which is attractive to her and I smell? What's really in question is my love for her. And I really think that that is what underlies the beautiful image that you brought, which is when God speaks to us in these terms, he's speaking to us in our youth, in that sort of childish beginning of the relationship where we might actually fear we've just come out of Egypt. We've been slaves. We don't have such a great sense of self-worth, right? We might fear that God actually doesn't love us that much. If we do the wrong thing, he'll flee. Over time, we see God just repeats to us again and again, I'm not going anywhere. My love is not conditional. Okay, my presence may be conditional, but my presence is conditional on you showing me that you love me. Right? We have to merit that expression. And then so much, as I said before, so much of the detail in the Mishkan and in the tabernacle and in the coming week, and when we'll speak about the role of the priesthood and how the priests have to present themselves, right? I believe so much of that is calling out from within us the physical embodiments of our love for God.
The greatest lovers of God were the forefathers, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. They're the people who love God the most in history, and they are the people that their presence always stands before God, their prayers stand before God. And the Bala Turim, I want to tell you, which is really my favorite commentator, and I don't know why, I just find his work to be very inspiring often. You know, just talks to you. I mean, they're all so amazing and wonderful. Just, you know, a person's got to find what is the famous phrase that the person doesn't really learn Torah except where his heart lies? So the Bala Turim, I found, says the most – I just was totally surprised by this. He says that the – okay, so let me go back. We're talking about the various parts of the tabernacle, including the altar, including the the tent around the poles that hold up the tent, that whole structure of the external of the tabernacle. And also it talks about the famous things that we all know about, the menorah. We'll get to that in a second. The showbread table, the altar, and the Ark of the Covenant. Now, the Ark of the Covenant has it's a kind of box, and it's got gold, wood, gold layering, and then it's got a covering, a top, a lid, and that lid is its own type of thing. It's kind of its own separate component, and it has these two cherubs, angels facing one another. There's a lot of talk about these angels. Sometimes they are two students learning Torah together. I've seen that explanation. Sometimes they are a man and a woman in an embrace, and they represent God's relationship to the Jewish people. The Baal Turim says something that I never saw before. He says that the Shnei Kruvim, the two cherubs, in Gematria, in the numerical value, are equal to Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. He says, Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob, Shayu Sham Kedei Laskil Zchut Avot, that the cherubs were there in order to remember the merit of the forefathers. Wait a minute, two cherubs, three forefathers, something's missing. He's right there, and he says that the third, and he doesn't say it's Jacob, but I think it's clear it is Jacob, is Moses, the man. The current man who's there, he represents the third of the forefathers.
I mean, this is because Baal Turim was a Kabbalist.
Yeah.
And we know that, Moshe Bifnim, Yaakov Labar, that Yaakov was the embodiment of every man, like the physical expression, and Moshe is that spirit, which constantly re-embodies in the sense that you yourself can be both Yaakov and can have the wisdom and the spirit of Moshe, that peace that emerges from between those two kruvim.
Is that then you nailed it? Mibein shnei kruvim, between the two cherubs, Rashi Tevot, the first letters are Mibein shnei kruvim. The first letters are Hey Shin Mem Moshe. He says so like there's Abraham, there's Isaac, and you're the Jacob, whoever you are, the Kohen Gadol at the time, Moses at the time. He represents the Jacob, the Jewish people at the time.
And every single one of us, because when we pray, when Jews pray, right, it's important to have that visual image because it begins here with the Mishkan, right? Everybody circles here and they're facing the Mishkan. But now we have Jews all over the world. You can come home soon. Right? And when they pray, where do they face? The land of Israel. And if you're facing in the land of Israel, what do you praise? Jerusalem. And if you're in Jerusalem, where do you face? The Temple Mount. And if you're on the Temple Mount, where do you face? To the Holy of Holies. And then the Gemara says, and if you're in the Holy of Holies, where do you face? Between the Kruvim. There's that empty space, which is not empty, but it's the space that always lies between two people when they interact. And so you get this amazing image of all of Israel in these concentric circles, facing inwards. On one level, they're facing each other. On the other level, what they're facing is what emerges between them, which is Shekhinah, which is the presence of God. Because in that sense, the presence of God is the collective experience of the Jewish people, of God's presence in the world.
That very spot between the two cherubs, that equidistant spot between those two, that's where the voice of God emanates from. Exactly from that. That's when it speaks out to Moses. I think incredible imagery. By the way, let's talk about a Talmudic passage that I found about a year ago on Daf Yomi, on the daily learning of the Talmud, which just blew my mind. It says that in the desert, when the Jews were walking around with the tabernacle, they would take it apart at some points, right? It would be this Lego thing, and it was just time to go, and you would just take it apart. So when they would take it apart, the Levites are commanded not to look at the pieces of the tabernacle as they're put into their, you know, travel bags. And you can understand why. It's not nice. It's nice when it's whole. When it sits in parts, it could be a bit of a kind of chilul Hashem. It could be a desecration of God's name. It's as though you break this thing where God's presence stood, and now you're kind of mobile. There's something a little bit, how should we say, it's like a person getting undressed.
It's immodest.
So the Talmud says, but wait, isn't it true, though, that all the Jewish people were allowed to walk past the Holy of Holies, and they would open up the curtains and let people peek right into the most
inner sanctum,
right, the most intimate of moments, which is this union of the two cherubs. And they would just peer right into it. And the answer the Talmud says is that there's a difference between the tabernacle and the temple. The tabernacle is like a woman who's betrothed. She's engaged to be married, yet she's still in her father's home. So she keeps herself yet fully...
At arm's length.
Right, arm's length from her would-be husband. As opposed to a woman who's already married to her husband, she doesn't have to conceal herself as much. And that is the difference between the tabernacle, the period of the time of the exile, when Jews are not in the land of Israel, and when the Jews are in the land of Israel, in full control of Jerusalem, with the temple. It's a completely different level of intimacy. It's a different level of intimacy.
It's because all three vessels are then in play. You have the Torah, you have the temple, and you have the land. And the three of them together can hold a power and intimacy of relationship, which... it's not available outside. And we see, as we'll discuss, God willing, when we get there, that there is actually a mistaken intimacy which is available in the wilderness, right? That ultimately leads some of the leaders of Israel to not want to go into the land, because they look into the land and it's very physical, it's earthy, it's involved in the problems of economics and politics and et cetera. I don't want to do that. Let's stay out here in the wilderness where things are pure. And what they didn't realize is that the real depth of the relationship, as it's true in marriage, right? You think when you're young and before you have any children, or even while you're dating and you're starry-eyed with romance, that's what love is. Which, okay, I hear it. But the reality is, I think that love emerges after deep struggle together and experience and growth and the nitty-gritty details of life.
Amen and emet, both of those. Meaning to say, I totally agree with that, and my experience has shown me that that's really true. The real love is, the real love of marriage starts down the line when you've gone through it all together. Now, speaking of unforeseen, you were saying that kind of you see only what you see in front of you, and you don't see down the line always. The deeper relationship is down the line. We're in the process here in this week's Torah portion of building the menorah. The menorah is really one of the penultimate symbols of Judaism. Star of David, amorphic.
Latecomer
and amorphic, not exactly clear. You know, it's the ancient way, a triangle is the ancient way of making a Dalet. Those are two Dalets, and David's name has two Dalets. It's actually a very perfect form, the Star of David, because it's actually how you dissect a circle. There's a lot of perfection in it's got 360 degrees. And 336. 36 is double chai, 36. There's a lot of mysticism behind the Star of David. But if you would kind of choose, what is the penultimate sign of Judaism, and one image, an iconic image that also symbolizes the Jewish mission that's spread light into this world, it's the menorah. And if you think about the menorah, it is, we don't usually think of it that way, but think of it as an object for a second. It is a strange object. It's a weird object. It's just, the way it's shaped is a little bit hard to make. It all comes, it's made out of gold. It's made out of, there's one central pillar that's holding all of it. And then the
branches
come out and they're all kind of weighing down on this central branch. Now, if you erased your mind right now of any knowledge of what a menorah looks like, and I commanded you to make a menorah, God commanded you to make a menorah, you would have a hard time. And if you wouldn't, Moses had a hard time. Moses was unable to visualize what God was trying to say. This is the Rashi and the Midrashim. He was unable to visualize it fully until God showed him an image. And there's a verse that says, "See and do according to the plans, the blueprints, which I have shown you here on the mountain. Do it according to that." And he had to be shown a full vision. If you look at the Rashi says that he showed him a menorah of fire. A menorah of fire. So my question always is, why did he show him a menorah of fire? He could have just shown him a menorah, show him just the JPEG, or the PNG. But why show him a menorah of fire? And I've come up with three answers for that. And the answers for the menorah of fire is the following, that potential answers for the menorah fire. One is that you should always know that if the menorah on this lower earth gets destroyed, there's a menorah up in the heavens, in the sphere, a menorah fire that exists. The original is up there with God. And it's like this flaming menorah that you cannot douse, you cannot put out, and it always exists. So if they're going to take your menorah away to the Vatican or something, don't worry, the original is still with us. That's number one. And number two is that we usually think of the light of the menorah as being it's the top. But God says, no, it's the whole thing is part of the light. And so many of our efforts, sometimes we don't know if we did an effort that led to something that concluded with total success, or we don't always see what our small efforts are part of. So God says, guess what? Every small effort is part of that light that reaches that's finally going to get turned on at the end. And as a Jewish people, we sometimes can get very down on the hard times that we face. But God says, no, it's all light until one day the very top will be lit. And finally, and I think this pertains to our show, a Spiritual Cafe with Rabbi Mike Foyer here, is that God is teaching Moses something about pedagogy, which is when you teach, when a student asks you a question, Rabbi, what's this and this? You can give him the bland JPEG answer. He says, when you teach it in fire. If I'm going to ask you a question, if I'm going to ask you about Judaism, don't show me a bland answer. Teach it in fire. Excite the kids. Let them see your passion about it. And that's the way to teach. He was teaching him about teaching, which is important because we're teachers. You're an active teacher.
I hear it. I mean, I think to me what it says is the extent of the demand of our mission. Meaning these lamps that are on top of the menorah, like you said, it's we commonly think of those as a source of light. And it's important to remember that we think of candles because we live in the world we live in. They were oil lamps. And it's critical that an oil lamp has oil, a wick, and flame. And it's often said that this is the metaphor for the nature of the soul in the world, right? That the soul is basically a wick dropped down into the world. The oil are the deeds which we do that we draw up through ourselves, and the light is that we give off into the world. Well, that's sweet and cute and all, but like you said, this is all resting on top of a lot of inert matter there, this big menorah. And I think that the message which I hear out of what you're saying is, you know, listen, that it begins with the refined deeds of the mitzvot that are very clear that this is what God wants you to do in order to bring light into the world. But you got to get into the thickness of the world, right? That you can draw light out of all the substance of the world. And in fact, that's the majority of the work to be done. And if your mitzvot are going to have true meaning, they have to be on top of, right, building a society, building a menorah, and truly making the world gold.
You know, Rabbi Mike, final thoughts here on Spiritual Cafe is that I don't know if people understand the time that we're living in, because we're living in a time where that matter has such a possibility to be refined through the greatest project of the Jewish people in 2,000 years, that is the building of the Jewish state, which is the vessel. It's a vessel to bring the Jewish people to the land of Israel, to fulfill the commandments, to make a light unto the world, to connect to God like they haven't in 2,000 years on a different level. And I often think to myself that we do not get it. We're living it and we're enjoying it, but we just don't see the grandness, the bigness of this project. And I lament that. I think not realizing the time you're living is remiss. You don't put in the oomph that you need to put into to be part of it.
I think that's a call for us in this month of Adar, where the Gemara says Mishen Nichnas Adar Marbim Besimcha, that when we come into Adar, it's usually read as we increase our joy. But I would also say we increase with joy, meaning we got to go big. We got to go big, and we have to show our joy in the bigness, and not the fear and the anxiety, I think, which is so often what blinds us to it. So let's get on mission.
Amen. All right, folks, you are listening to the Yishai Fleischer Show, Spiritual Cafe, broadcasting live from Jerusalem. We are at Beit Midrash Sulam Yaakov, sulamyaakov.com, and Rabbi Mike Foyer joins me here weekly. I want to hear from you. Write me an email. Don't get lazy. Your little tiny emails make me feel, gosh, you know, it gives us a little push. It's the tip at the end of the meal. All you have to do is just say, Yishai, Rabbi Mike, I heard you. It turned me on for the Shabbat for the week. So don't get lazy. Write a little email, yishai@thelandofisrael.com. Anything you say to Rabbi Mike, I will surely and gladly pass it over to him. Check out his other podcasts at sulamyaakov.com. And stay tuned, stay strong, stay connected, be part of the story, and get ready for something big, because you indeed are living in an amazing time. Stay tuned, and shalom.